You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A new exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History, Mythic Creatures, Dragons, Unicorns, and Mermaids, examines the natural and cultural roots of some of the world's most enduring imaginary creatures. Also at the museum is an IMAX film called Dinosaurs Alive, in which computer-generated imagery brings dinosaurs to life based on what we know so far from the fossil record. Joining me to discuss both of them are Michael Novacek, Senior Vice President and Provost of the American Museum of Natural History, and Mark Norell, who is the Curator and Chair of the Museum's Division of Paleontology. It is my great pleasure to welcome them both back to the show. Hello.
Thanks. You very much.
Now, the film and the exhibition cover different subjects, but do you see them as related in any way, Michael?
Well, yes, in some way, because dinosaurs, among other natural creatures, are the inspiration for a lot of myth and mythical creatures. In fact, the show explicitly points to some examples where dinosaurs themselves, even dinosaurs from the Gobi Desert, which is featured in the movie, our expeditions in the movie, dinosaurs from the Gobi Desert may have been the inspiration for certain mythic creatures like griffins, for example.
How would that have been if humans came along so many years after dinosaurs were extinct?
Well, it's based because of the skeletons of these animals.
So they found the fossils and they said, wow, look at this bone. There must have been some incredible creature.
It's very interesting. Some of there's a dinosaur called Protoceratops, which has a beak-like skull. And it doesn't have wings like a griffin, but it has a lot of the other traits that you might expect in the skeleton of a griffin. And these were found in localities in Central Asia, and many of those localities were near sources of gold. And, of course, griffins guarded gold. So these kinds of historical coincidences may have been more than coincidence.
Now, Mark, you're one of the show's curators. Did you ever wonder about devoting an exhibition of this sort at a museum that has a history of serious science to creatures that never actually existed?
Well, I mean, I think it is serious science in the sense that we're looking at some of the actual living animals and fossil animals that may have influenced the way in which that we think these mythical creatures looked. So there's that aspect of it that's serious science. And it's also interesting to point out that, you know, before the age of modern science is that myth really was the way which people interpreted things that they didn't understand or they didn't see around all the time.
In your travels around the world, have you come across stories about mythic creatures everywhere?
Pretty much everywhere. I mean, that mythic creatures are a real universal to almost every culture or to every culture on the planet. And one of the interesting things is that we see a lot of the same sorts of animals come up independently in cultures all around the world.
And many of them not only are fantastic in form, but also have magical powers. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that whenever there's something that you can't go out and nobody would, you know, come home and say that their dog or their sheep has magical powers, but if it's some animal which that you can't study, you can't capture, that it's only the thing of legend, that it's very easy to imbue them with magical powers.
As you said, some of these things pop up all over the world. For example, mermaids, you find them in Africa, in the Caribbean, in Europe. Is it because the stories get passed on from culture to culture, or is it because they are all inspired by similar things that people have seen in the sea?
Well, I think that it's both. I mean, in some cases that there's universals, like most cultures have something about giant birds or giant people. But the mermaids is one which we know quite a bit about in the sense that mermaids made their way from Western Europe to West Africa when ships first started to travel on the West African coast, and that the local people thought that these things weren't just decorative that were on the prows of the ships in this really auspicious spot, but really considered them to be deities that they worshipped. And a cult called the cult of Mamiwata occurred in West Africa, where these mermaid images are looked at as good luck charms and good luck signs. Then with the slave trade, as it moved from West Africa into the Caribbean, where it's venerated in the voodoo religion as a deity called La Sirene.
Well, and the voodoo religion in Haiti reminds us that Christopher Columbus reported seeing mermaids near Haiti. There are books and maps from the 16th century that are depicting all sorts of sea monsters, including mermaids. You think the mermaids are inspired by some living creatures?
Oh, could be, certainly, and there's some evidence of that. A variety of things, including manatees, which are not particularly attractive mermaids, I guess you would say, but they may be
from a distance.
And in fact, you know, as pointed out in the show, there's a video as a person on the screen, a scientist on the screen, is saying, well, you can imagine how terrifying and strange some of these creatures of the open ocean were as these ships first crossed these great expanses of water. The giant squid is a great example of that. I mean,
and they would have seen them?
Yes.
Don't the giant squid pretty much stay underwater?
Well, they may have seen them floating to the top in some cases, or maybe rare cases where they may have caught a glimpse. It's true they're open or mid-ocean creatures, deeper ocean creatures, but there are all kinds of things. There's strange spouts of whales before they were recognized as whales, and you could go on and on.
My guests are Michael Novacek and Mark Norell of the American Museum of Natural History. We're talking about two things that are being featured at the museum right now, an exhibit, Mythic Creatures, Dragons, Unicorns, and Mermaids, and also an IMAX film called Dinosaurs Alive, and we'll get to that in a moment. There's a Fiji, F-E-E-J-E-E, mermaid in the show. What's that made of?
Well, the Fiji mermaid is just this class of basically tourist items that were made throughout Southeast Asia in the 19th century. And what they are is that they're usually a fish's tail and then either a paper mache or a taxidermied monkey that fits onto this to give the illusion of a small mermaid.
And they were done as a kind of like a sideshow attraction?
Well, either as a sideshow attraction or maybe in some cases even to deceive. I mean, the one that we have, that there's some evidence that perhaps that it was the one used by P.T. Barnum in his museum in the 19th century.
Are people still making fakes of this sort today?
Certainly. I mean, it's after the tsunami a couple of years ago over the holidays that all over the internet that there was images of mermaids that had washed up on the shores of India and throughout Southeast Asia. And you would look at the images of it, and it was just things that had been cobbled together from parts of dead animals with fishes.
One of the most enduring is the Loch Ness Monster. Michael, didn't someone just claim to catch it on video last week?
Those claims come weekly. I mean, you get very frequent claims of people focused on these things, and there are all kinds of sightings. I should say that Mark and I were both paleontologists, and we have fairly deep files on letters from people who write us saying they saw Loch Ness-like monsters off the coast of the Philippines or off the coast of Australia or in some lake in some remote corner of Eurasia. We get these. There are all kinds of sightings.
And is it not possible? Because every so often we come upon a fish that we thought went extinct a million years ago. Could there be some kind of dragon, kind of dinosaur type things still living in the ocean that we're not aware of?
One's hesitant to say it's impossible, especially in the deep ocean, because there are corners of that realm that are unexplored. And indeed, there are some really dramatic new discoveries of deep water creatures, fishes, and other things. On the other hand, and I should also say that there have been some remarkable discoveries of some rather large animal, an animal called the sayola, which is a kind of an antelope, fairly large antelope-sized creature, was discovered in Vietnam about a decade ago. And Cuvier in the early 1800s said it's unlikely that humans would discover anything on land larger than about a pig size for the rest of time. But here we have a creature that's really large. So these discoveries do occur.
But even when scientists say it's impossible, like unicorns or Yeti, Bigfoot, there are still people who swear by it, don't they, Mark?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, so much of mythic beasts are tied up within people's spiritual cultures as well as with, you know, pop culture that large groups of people I get letters all the time from people who think that dragons exist. And in some sense, dragons do exist because to people who, especially in Asia, I mean, Asian people would say dragons exist. I mean, are they physical things that you could go out and see and touch every day? No. But as spiritual entities, is that they're very real things to them.
Who designed the models of the winged dragon and the Kraken's giant tentacles?
They were designed by our exhibition department, and then they were developed by a company in New Jersey, which deals mostly in building
sets. So you're engaged in making fakes as well.
Yeah.
At least we have to tell people they are fakes.
You organize the creatures by where they're supposedly found in water, land, and air.
Right.
Are there differences in the way these stories develop, do you think?
Not really. I mean, I think that if we look at the stories and the natural history tie-ins, the one thing that's really apparent is that humans have really fertile imaginations. And certainly that even in the cases where we have natural history tie-ins, it's impossible to determine whether that the fossils inspired the myth or the fossils were interpreted in light of the myth. So that it's hard to tell which one came first.
My guests are Mark Norell, curator and chair of the American Museum of Natural History's Division of Paleontology, and Michael Novacek, Senior Vice President and Provost of the American Museum of Natural History. We will continue our conversation and also clue you into the slideshow that we have on our webpage at wnyc.org called Mythical Creatures. We'll be back right after this. We're back with two paleontologists from the American Museum of Natural History, Michael Novacek, Senior Vice President and Provost of the Museum, and Mark Norell, Curator and Chair of the Museum's Division of Paleontology. And we're talking about two exhibits, well, I'm not exactly sure we should call the film an exhibit, but two things that you can find at the museum these days. One, an exhibit called Mythic Creatures, Dragons, Unicorns, and Mermaids, and also a film called Dinosaurs Alive. Let's talk about that for a moment. This is an IMAX film, so it's not just like making any other movie where you can use some computer-generated imagery. IMAX films really reveal every little nook and cranny, don't they?
Yeah, the technology challenge is very a big one, and indeed the filmmakers had to notch up the effort beyond things like Jurassic Park and so forth, because those dinosaurs are big on the screen, and the resolution required and the subtleties of movement and so forth to be captured. So that was a long and expensive process. Fortunately, the technology has also improved since some of those other movies.
Another disadvantage you had, perhaps, is that you had to base yours completely on fact, whereas Jurassic Park could play fast and loose, couldn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
The Velociraptor and the Protoceratops, I hope I pronounced that right, are shown fighting when they're buried by a sand dune. Can you tell how these dinosaurs died based on fossils you found?
In some cases. I mean, it's one of the reasons that we excavated in Mongolia, because most places fossils are found, the animals die and then they become decomposed and scavenged and everything else. But a lot of the animals that we find in Mongolia were actually killed by the very things which buried them, by these collapsing sand dunes. So it captures behaviors once in a while. And there is a fossil that's been found of a Velociraptor tied up in a death throes with Protoceratops. There's also been fossils found that we've excavated that of dinosaurs sitting on top of their nests brooding their eggs. So you're actually capturing behaviors in some cases.
It's sort of a Pompeii-like situation, really.
But what don't we know in Pompeii that the people looked a certain way because everyone else around them looked that way? But we have to guess at things like whether these animals had feathers or whether they were green or blue or red or pink or whatever.
Well, green or blue, red or pink, we do have to guess. But I think that we can make some speculative guesses there. Whether they had feathers or not, we do have information from close relatives, for instance, of Velociraptor found in northern China, which have, you know, complete feathery body covering over their entire bodies. So that just in the same way that no one's ever found an Australopithecine like Lucy or anything with hair, no one's ever found a Velociraptor with feathers. But because we have hair and chimps have hair, and because birds have feathers and these animals from China have fossil feathers, we would infer then that Velociraptor was also feathered.
So this living creature is a direct descendant from Velociraptor?
Not a direct descendant. I mean, certainly that Velociraptor is among the dinosaurs which are most closely related to modern birds. But the things from northern China are actual fossils. I mean, that they're not living. I mean, we find fossils once in a while. When they're remarkably preserved, they're covered with feathers.
You mentioned the Gobi as a great place, and much of the dinosaur hunting, fossil hunting, has taken place there. But there are parts in the United States as well, New Mexico, Montana.
Sure.
What makes them such good places to find fossils?
There are several regions in the world that are particularly good for fossil collecting, especially if we're thinking of dinosaurs and other animals that lived at that time. And they tend to be very arid regions where there's a lot of sculpturing by wind and water, exposing a lot of surface area. You know, if you can walk more of those canyons and those surfaces, you have a greater chance of finding bone. But as Mark said, even compared to the American West, the Gobi has, for example, some very interesting properties in preservation. These remains haven't been broken up or scavenged, so the skeletons, by and large, are more complete.
So it would be best for preservation if the area were really dry?
In general, yes.
Why not the Sahara, then?
Well, so the Sahara does yield some very spectacular fossils. But the dryness also pertains to the current situation. Paleontologists, as I've written before, don't like trees. They get in the way of the view. You know, the rocks are what they're interested in. And indeed, the tropics are one of the worst places to look for fossils because there's so much reworking of those soils, so much erosion that, you know, you're not getting the kinds of rocks that are preserving these animals or helping you find them.
Now, would there be bones there if we could really just dig deep enough, or would they have been destroyed because of the environment that is now in those areas?
Yeah, so in some cases, you do find fossils in jungles. I mean, I've worked a little bit in Cuba in the mountains, as well as in Laos and Thailand in the rainforest, and certainly you do find fossils. They're just harder to find. I mean, you're really restricted to areas which are like places which people have practiced slash and burn agriculture that have then become eroded.
Or quarried.
Or the banks of rivers and that kind of thing. Yeah.
But we can assume that the dinosaurs lived everywhere on Earth?
They've been found on every continent.
The film has archival footage of paleontologists like Roy Andrews Chapman uncovering fossils in the 1920s, and then it brings us up to today. Obviously, transportation has improved since the 20s, but what's changed since then in the way that you look for dinosaur fossils and study paleontology?
I think one of the interesting things about paleontology is what's not changed. A lot of the things that we do when we go out there are exactly the kinds of things that Roy Chapman Andrews did. And in the end, you've got to get there, usually with a vehicle, and you get your crew there, and you have to walk around a lot and look at bones on the ground. We do have some technology now that he didn't have, including helicopters, which are useful for obvious reasons, and also satellite imagery, which we do rely on for looking for new likely areas, and also for all other kinds of purposes in terms of geologic mapping.
Although I'm assuming also that one of the things you're looking for is places where there's been little development, because it would be a lot easier to find stuff there.
The places are always the best if you're the first person there. And we've been fortunate enough in many places in Central Asia to really be the first paleontologists ever to come up on these areas. So you can actually see lots of bones weathering out right on the surface.
Is this the same sort of thing as you find in Africa where the early hominid remains are discovered because the rocks have been pulled apart, and so we can actually go back thousands and thousands of years?
Yeah, so when the rocks were laid down, that they're laid down horizontally, and then they're uplifted and then eroded into canyons and badlands, and that's where we find the specimens.
Olduvai Gorge is very reminiscent. I've been to Olduvai Gorge, and it looks very much like a little pocket of badlands in the Gobi Desert.
Are there remote places that you would like to be able to get to but are too difficult, too remote?
Usually the places, it's not a question of remoteness. It's usually a question of political turmoil. I mean, certainly.
So China was off limits for the Gobi. Mongolia was off limits for quite a while.
China was off limits. In fact, I'll be off in a couple of weeks or next week to start an excavation season with my colleagues at Beijing University, which is right adjacent to where the Chinese nuclear test site is, and that was off limits for Americans up until quite recently.
The film says that only about 2% of dinosaur species have been discovered, which leaves an awful lot to find.
I think that that's a vast overestimate. I
mean,
I think it's more like 0.001. I mean, certainly traditional dinosaur time goes from about 65 million years ago to 235 million years ago, about 170 million years. During that time period, we only have 1,500 species of dinosaurs that are preserved for 170 million years.
That's nowhere near.
It's orders of magnitude off.
And I'm sure some of them will never turn up because there are no remains anymore. They've been destroyed by nature.
Yeah, the way in which the dinosaur fossils preserve is very selective. Rainforests are richest environments we have now. Don't preserve anything.
Now, there are a lot of disputes these days over who owns the art that is found in tombs and other parts of countries that are rich in artifacts. Is this a problem with fossils as well?
Absolutely. Fossils have become much more valuable to collectors. They're valuable monetarily and artistically, aesthetically. But many countries are also quite restrictive in the removal of fossils and their exportation. Mongolia has a national law that protects its treasures, and it regards its dinosaur and other fossils as treasures. So we've actually been lucky enough to collect these beautiful specimens, bring them back to New York and study them and prepare them and so forth, and even exhibit them, with the understanding that they'll eventually return to the Mongolian people, and we have indeed returned some beautiful specimens.
If I had a plot of land in northern New Mexico and was digging to plant some tomatoes and came across a fossil or two or three, would I be the owner of it, or would the United States be the owner?
Each country has its different laws and regulations. I mean, in the United States, what you find on private land is yours.
Oh, so I'm moving to Abiquiu tomorrow.
Yeah. Argentina, for instance, even on private land, anything found below the surface is the patrimony of the Argentine people. So,
now, when you first came here, Mark, you were one of a rare group of paleontologists who were claiming that modern birds grew out of the dinosaurs, mostly. I guess it was only the carnivorous dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. Is that pretty much the accepted thing today?
Yeah, I mean, it's very much established within the scientific community that not only are birds evolved from dinosaurs, but birds are a kind of living dinosaur.
So dinosaurs did not go extinct.
That's right.
Well, I'll think about that the next time I have some chicken. I want to thank you both so much for being with us. We've been talking with Mark Norell and Michael Novacek of the American Museum of Natural History. There is the exhibit, Mythic Creatures, Dragons, Unicorns, and Mermaids, that will be running for quite a while now, right?
Yeah, it runs up until early January of 2008.
And then what about the IMAX film, Dinosaurs Alive, which is both real footage and then computer-generated footage? Mm-hmm. Obviously, we don't have any real images of dinosaurs.
We don't, except for birds.
we've established that. But I believe that those dinosaurs are still alive because they are so effective in the film.
Yeah, exactly. And I think some of the people who attend the film do, too, from the hooting and the hollering that you have there. But, the film will carry on for many months. You know, we rotate some of the IMAX films, but this one will probably be coming back quite a bit. It's very popular with our audiences.
Are they shown elsewhere?
Yes.
Yeah, it's showing several. I know it's showing in Charlotte, North Carolina, for instance, right now, and it's showing in Washington, D.C. right now also.
And the West Coast and several places. There are a number of places, and it will be shown worldwide, actually.
Thank you both so much. Oh, just one other thing. I really think I just have to address it. What do you say to people, since there are still so many, who support creationist theory when you talk about the dinosaur fossil record?
Well, I think one of the issues with creationism is that, of course, we respect people's beliefs, and people have many beliefs on this. But the importance of the scientific mission in the museum and our mission in science education is to distinguish science from other areas of perception and knowledge. And there's no scientific basis, for example, for the notion that humans and dinosaurs lived at the same time. That's just absolutely not what science tells us. And so it's important to really distinguish science as a pursuit from religious beliefs, whatever they may be. So I think our problem comes with the fact where people are attempting to suggest that creationism is somehow something that we can document from the fossil record, that somehow scientifically obtainable or observable, and it's just simply not.
And they find links with the flood and the story of Noah.
Yeah. But see, the problem with these ideas about the flood and Noah is whether or not the stories are correct, whether or not there was once a big flood at some time, the way the time is compressed in a literal reading of the Bible is just not supported by our knowledge of the immensity of time based on scientific evidence.
Michael Novacek and Mark Norell of the American Museum of Natural History, thank you both so much for being with us. And a reminder that you can see a slideshow on our show page at wnyc.org/slideshow from Mythical Creatures.